Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Our guest today is Dr. Hank Schiffers. Dr. Schiffers is currently the executive managing partner of his own consulting company, Schiffers, a position he has held for the past 8 years. Dr. Schiffers has held numerous leadership roles in companies providing products to healthcare organizations and physicians, such as Abbott and Stryker. He completed his MD-PhD at the University of Dusseldorf in 1996 and completed his MBA at the University of Tennessee in 2003. He has served as an adjunct faculty member at the University of Tennessee since 2004. Hank is passionate about helping entrepreneurs monetize their medical innovations, an area that he has been focused on for many years. He has expertise in lean startups, creating a lean sales and marketing force, and lean safe processes. He has also been involved in machine learning and artificial intelligence. He is sharing his insights with you today regarding successfully launching products in both the U.S. and EU markets. So once again, buckle up and get ready for a fascinating conversation about healthcare innovation in two very different healthcare environments. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss a minute of this. Welcome to today's episode of Pemba On Demand. Today, I'm excited to have Dr. Hank Schiffers with us. Our conversation today is going to be talking about entrepreneurship, monetizing medical innovations, a guide for physician entrepreneurs. Hank, I'm really happy to have you on the show today. Welcome to Pemba On Demand.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity. It's great to be here.
Had a little bit of an interesting challenge. I've never interviewed someone with quite as big of a difference in time zones. Hank is in Europe, in Germany, and I'm recording this from the Eastern Standard Time Zone. So that was a little bit interesting. Not quite as challenging maybe as interviewing someone from Asia or something like that, but it was still a little bit different for me. So I'm glad we were able to work this out.
And I much appreciate you taking time this early in the morning in your time zone for me. Thank you.
Yeah, well, you're welcome. So I wonder if you could start out by just kind of sharing with us a little bit about your journey into entrepreneurship in industry. I know that your career has been in Europe, but that you've had some connections to the U.S. as well. So talk to us a little bit about your career and just tell us kind of what you're doing right now, I guess, to start with, and then we'll go a little bit into your background. But tell us what you're involved in right now, what your current role is.
Okay. Well, my current role is that I'm the owner of my own company. Mm-hmm. And what we do is we consult with startups on the one hand side, especially if they are trying to monetize ideas, concepts, products, services, and they are looking for ways to enter the EU market. That's one part. The other part is that we basically help the large companies to understand how to transform or to disrupt their sales and marketing forces based on the changes in the environment that require transformation and or disruption. From a journey part, because you were asking for that, I'm half German, half French. And when I was quite young, 16, I started working in healthcare and hospitals. And so I had quite a long career in hospitals before I actually became a physician. And during that time, actually, I already took the decision that my way to add value in healthcare would rather be outside of the classic stream of being in a hospital or in an office, because I actually met people when I was working in Hong Kong in 1993 that worked for industry. And I saw how much difference they made with their product in a certain clinical setting, which was anesthesia at the time. And I was extremely impressed. That's why I chose what I do.
So did you grow up in Germany, in France, or a combination of going back and forth between both countries?
No, actually, I grew up in Germany.
Okay.
My mom is French, but I grew up in Germany. spend my free time in France.
So you started working in the healthcare and in healthcare at a fairly young age. And then I know you went on to medical school and got your MD, PhD. Did you go into postgraduate training in a clinical field, or did you transition directly into working in industry or entrepreneurial type ventures?
The way that the medical study and education was structured at the time, it's a long time ago. When I did it around the year 2000 was the following year, 6 years of medical education in the university setting, followed by 1 year of on-site training in a hospital. And at the end of that, you had an additional 20 months that you would do normally in a hospital setting. I did it in an office-based environment because I already chose to step not out, but go a different path in providing care to patients. And after that would have been my specialization, which I didn't do. So I'm not a specialist. I'm basically a GP equivalent to what you would see in the US, but I'm not a specialist. I'm fully board certified, but not a specialist.
Okay. Okay. And besides that 20 months of ambulatory experience, did you set up your own practice in a clinical area, or did after that 20 months, then you transitioned into more of the industrial space?
Well, after that time, I was in the industrial space 100% of my time.
Okay.
Before that, during my entire medical education, I was basically doing two things. I was working in hospitals and in ambulatory care, finance my education. And therefore, I was always very much in touch with how the things were actually done. Actually, it drove my decision to step into industry during that time was the major point there.
So you really had a long career in industry and entrepreneurship, and I know you've worked in many areas. But right now, as a leader in your own company, you mentioned that you're focused on helping companies, startups, sort of in the European market, or you're helping larger industries. Explain a little bit more to me about what it's like to do a startup in Europe, in Germany, compared to the US.
Compared to the US is an interesting question. Thank you for that. And we're talking life science startups. And within the life science arena, you have basically two types of startups. The ones that will end up in a regulatory field, being a drug, a medical device, a medical service that underlies regulation. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is everything that I would today categorize as self-improvement, more or less, to paint it black and white for 1 second. If you are entering the life science arena in the EU, most people would perceive this as more complex than the US, because more or less you have one regulatory system in the US. More or less we have 17 different here. But that's not true. The interesting thing about doing startups in the EU is that you are way faster to market. We talk years compared to the US, because the processes in the US are way, way, way slower than they're actually here. Hmm. The second thing is that once you have achieved the reimbursement in socialized medicine, well, you're actually getting paid, which is something that you wouldn't necessarily have in the US. Let me give you a real quick an example. During the financial crisis, I was working for a major manufacturer of hips and knees in the US. Without going into the details, due to laying off people, the sales in hips and knees dropped quite significantly, even more so in capital equipment. Throughout the same time in EU, you had a steady growth, simply because it's decoupled. Mm-hmm. So bottom line is, going into the EU with a startup is super, super interesting. If you are able to standardize 90% of your processes and willing to put the work into this, and then have those 5 to 10%, which are really different from system to system, that you adopt to the different systems, and then it's part of a rollout strategy.
Okay. So I guess one of the questions is, and I know one of the things that we wanted to kind of share today is that if I was a physician here in the US and I had some type of an innovative idea, let's just take an example that it is in kind of a regulatory environment. It might be some type of a product that I need to get approved through these regulatory organizations that you were referring to. What are things that a physician would need to do in the EU to sort of take that concept and get it all the way out to market? And What role would you play in helping with that?
Okay, two questions. I'll try to answer them. The first thing is you need to be aware that there are other markets outside of the US that may be more interesting or maybe not to your specific idea. That's the first step, because if you are in the US, most of the vast majority of ideas in the US gets matured from a very local base of private placements. So if you're living in Atlanta, it's probably a group of people from Atlanta that's going to finance you. If you go back to them, say, hey, by the way, I want to kick this off in France, they probably mistake you for taking vacation. And that's probably not leading you to any goal. The most important thing that I would advise anybody who does anything in life sciences is if you have an idea, take one step back. Look at how is this idea served today? How is the underlying problem, the underlying challenge for a patient served today? Then try to figure out how is this measured? How could you translate what you maybe do better into a one sentence that you could address to a patient he would understand and be willing to drive 200 miles or a couple of hundred miles so that you would actually be able to redirect the patients towards wherever you offer your service. Once you know that, then you ask somebody who really understands if there is reimbursement needed, how reimbursement works in the US, plus some EU markets, maybe the UK, most of the time not the UK. That's often a misunderstanding. People out of the US like to go to the UK because of culture and language. Most of the time, it's a big mistake. Then probably something in Asia, which would be South Korea, which could be maybe Japan, depending on the solution, and maybe Australia. Once you understood those countries, you will learn where would you access the reimbursement result in what type of payment and what other challenges do you may find along this route. Because obviously being reimbursed doesn't necessarily mean anybody uses your product. To make a long story short, once you understand that, you go back to your drawing board in a perfect world and think, are there things I learned that I can implement in my product? Let me give you an example. If you're building a knee implant, and originally the knee implants were absolutely maximum 90 degree flex, if you are the first one who can fully flex, it might be a great idea to go into countries where the primary religion is Muslim, because that's the way they pray. Christians can live with 90 degrees angle, Muslims not so much. And there you would immediately touch on something that in one sentence you can click to everybody and everybody would say, oh yeah, well, that is fantastic. This is exactly what I want for my patients.
Interesting. Interesting. So have you been in a situation where you have worked with US physicians? Because our audience is heavily US physicians. Have you had the opportunity to work with a US physician entrepreneur and help them monetize a medical innovation in a market outside of the US?
Oh, yes, of course. Okay. Actually, it's probably 50% of my business. The vast majority of projects I can't speak about, but because usually there are NDA signs. But there are projects like startups, like, for example, HeartFlow, which is a US-based, AI-based company to visualize based on CT scans with the help of AI, how the blood flow around the heart is. That we did around the year 2016-17, if I recall this right, which ultimately, with a lot of more work of other people beside me, led then to a full reimbursement in the German market, basically at the beginning of this year in the outpatient market, which has never been done before. And so there are plenty of these projects where once you have the right people who are willing to understand that their perceived complexity of the European market or the perceived downside of so-called socialized medicine, I never understood what that actually means, is actually an advantage for them. And we have very small startup. We currently work with a startup out of Canada that is introducing a very, very innovative mask systems for personal protection. And we will do the entire process with them. It's a company called Forged Air, which will be launched in the US shortly as well. They have very interesting things that they address actually the needs of the individual who needs to wear a mask for occupational safety.
So when we talk about physician entrepreneurs, and a few, I think about 2 or 3 months ago, we did a show with a group of entrepreneurs talking about the various stages in the entrepreneurial journey. Is there a a particular point at which the your company or other companies like yours begin to work with the entrepreneur to begin to monetize the innovation? I guess at what point does that process start in the entrepreneurial journey?
Well, there are usually three points in time when we start working with people. My preferred point is at the very, very beginning. Ideally, people come to me and say, hey, I got an idea. I got it on paper. Could you have a quick look whether this makes sense somewhere else?
Okay.
Okay. But that's usually not a realistic point. That is something that when I work with Pemba students who join the program specifically because they have either an idea or maybe a first patent or even already a company, this is the point when they call me and say, hey, you're a Pemba alumni. Would you do me a favor and just have a quick look?
Okay.
Because that's the point where you can focus the company on providing measurable value to patients at the earliest stage, which then makes a lot of things easier in the deployment, in the reimbursement, in the clinical evidence part. The sooner you do that, the better it is. It's the hardest lesson to learn because most of the time it means that the inventor has to let the baby go a little bit at that point. The usual time people come to me is when they either try to cross the ocean because they heard somehow this is a good thing to do, which usually means that we have to do a lot of cleanup first because there is a lot, there is already a perception around what is Europe or what is Europe, what isn't Europe. And there is no such thing as Europe for the healthcare market to start with. And so there's a lot of cleanup we have to do first, and then we have to refocus that. The third part, which is my least preferred one, is when people already had the experience of trying to deploy something here, and given to that traditional structure, they made mistakes that they repeated 2-3 times before realizing there is something we don't know, we don't know. These are, if they work out, the best projects, but on the other hand, they are the most complex projects because it really means disruption usually of what people have thought before.
So are there particular areas of innovation right now that seem to be primed for growth in the life science area? Is there an area where most of the innovation seems to be really taking off and focusing right now?
Let me start with an answer for the EU market and then just broaden it from my perspective. For the EU market, we had a very dramatic change in the way you register medical devices. In medical devices, the change is now you need to prove what you do. Before that is you could basically claim whatever you wanted. Now you need to actually be able to prove it. And this is something you need to put into your initial design. Otherwise, you will fail miserably. The process itself is perceived being more complicated. I actually think it's a fantastic process because it provides more safety for the patient, more value to the patient. And if you do it correctly, it actually provides more protection once you have completed it for you in comparison to other competitors. For existing products that need recertification, this means you need to undergo a rigorous process of either killing that product if it is not able to undergo that process. So you basically take it out of the market, you clean up your portfolio, number one. Number two, if you have products that are necessary, you need to rework them maybe. And the third one is if you have innovation, you need to build this into the innovation process immediately. If it is not a medical device in the classic sense, so if, for example, it is something that is more around the life science arena, self-optimization, then we usually counsel customers to put on a very strict data privacy regulation because we are leading the game in the EU for everybody around the globe. Well, but with AI, it's going to come to you really, really, really fast. People want their data under their own control, and it makes sense. In life science, even more so than with anything else. The important thing for us is so get your data correctly. Make sure you have data that you're actually allowed to use. If we talk a little bit more about AI later, it's even more important than that for training data. The second part is that if you are looking into this part of non-regulatory products, build it as if you were trying to put it into the regulatory market. Because if you can do that, You can be as fast as you can innovate with anything else, but you already have the processes ready in case at a later point you want to decide to have a derivative of your product to enter reimbursement. If you don't do that, you will end up like plenty of apps that do all kinds of things. And they say, oh, there is a reimbursement for apps in Germany and France. Let's go there. And Germany and France says, well, no, thank you. And then they miserably fail, which is the standard procedure they do at the moment.
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode. So it sounds like there are major differences. We didn't talk much about the Asian market, but it certainly sounds like there's major differences between the EU and the US. Do you find that over the past 5 years that the recognition of the advantages of starting in the EU for US entrepreneurs in this segment of the market has changed at all?
Yes, it has. Unfortunately, to the wrong side. The complexity in the MDR system, so the regulation for medical devices, perceived as a hurdle mm-hmm. in the US, which it actually is not. You just have to have the right stuff to understand what you need to do, and then it's as simple as anything else. The other point that is really important from my perspective is that most of these products that are booming in the US are playing outside of the classic regulatory market. It's more self-improvement. And the self-improvement market does exist in the EU as well. It's an out-of-pocket market. It does exist. It works well. And the mechanisms are similar to the US mechanisms on how to sell. The only difference is if you, at a later point, want to join the reimbursement market, which makes total sense for some of those products, then you should prepare it from day one. And that sometimes is in conflict with perceived not being able to innovate as fast as you want, because there are certain regulatory steps that you have to include in your, let's say, update process and other things.
So Hank, I know over the past 15 years in your career, you've been involved in AI as well. What is the impact that AI is having in healthcare innovation and bringing new and innovative products to market?
Well, I started working with machine learning and later on AI because I was educated in using lean management at the University of Tennessee in the healthcare environment, because obviously I was always looking for measurable value to the patient. And therefore, at a certain point in time, I realized that in my geography, most of the data we have at hand is not really, really good because of privacy reasons sometimes. Or actually because of misunderstood privacy reasons, I should say. And thus, starting to learn with first machine learning and later on AI enabled me and others, obviously, to get information and understand information that was loosely connected in the beginning. The way that AI will lead us is completely disruptive. It's not a transformation. I know plenty of my colleagues working with AI that come back to me and say, I get this result, I have no idea why. That is one of the biggest challenges. The way that AI will help in life sciences is that AI will lead us from a diagnostic standpoint to seeing things a long time before we as a human being actually could see it, no matter what our training is. There is currently an AI out for breast cancer. This AI has proven to see the breast cancer 5 years before physicians do, fully trained people, radiologists, not the average Hank Schiffers. The other thing in therapeutics, AI will lead us to be pinpointing things, being it to steer robotic-assisted things, being it to design drugs. The ability to test out drugs with the help of AI is absolutely insane. It's great on the good side of things. And on the other side, it's something that once it comes to the, let's say, operational side, AI will help us to basically simplify all processes if we open up the data pool for it, being it making sure that if I have an operational surgical spot, it's actually filled with a suitable patient, even if three other patients were sick that same day, I still do not waste that slot. I don't waste that capacity. So the vast application I see here is really around waste reduction and fraud reduction, because AI is fantastic to find fraud in life sciences as well. So these are basically the things where I see disruptive processes happen. For future generations of physicians, it will be an amazing blend of, on the one hand side, to tackle things that will avoid problematic situations to actually occur in cancer and in other diseases. And it may transform us actually to the sentence, there is no money in prevention. Actually, there might be money in prevention in this case, so that we may even reduce the likelihood of other diseases occurring, like side effect of virus infections and other things.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of areas that you see AI as having an impact.
Yes.
Professional lives. Can you talk a little bit? You talked about the early breast cancer detection. Are there other AI applications specifically that you've been involved with that are already being marketed in the EU or in the US that you're aware of that are having this disruptive impact?
Well, there is. I mentioned HeartFlow earlier because they're using AI for a long time already, more than 10 years, in cardiac disease, basically reducing the likelihood that you have to have a catheter put into your heart to see whether you have an occlusion or not. There is another company that does this, a similar thing, but what they do is actually look for inflammation around your blood vessel on the heart. This is absolutely brilliant because they can predict whether you will have a heart attack in 10 years. And they are actually trying to figure out how to monetize this today, because currently all the doctors say, hey, well, I don't have a code for that. Okay. So these are challenges that come with the disruption. Our system has big challenges at the moment to be fast enough to follow, so to enable those things. There is plenty of AI in markets where you have under-regulated markets, where you basically can use your iPhone to check your eye and see whether you are starting to be diabetic. You can have plenty of things in the sleep world where you can start measuring whether your snoring is already combined with sleep apnea and you require therapy or not. So I do not think that there is any area in healthcare and in the classic medicine that won't be touched by AI. In elderly care, helping people to stay longer at home by making sure they drink enough, by making sure they didn't have an accident and are lying somewhere on the floor, by calling the right people in transportation, right? Currently, we have usually in most countries, we have underserved areas. We will see drone picking up patients and bringing them to the respective hospital that has a slot. This will be organized by AI over the short and the long term.
Yeah, I think it's going to be amazing. I was just talking with a person here in the U.S. who's starting up a project to do medication drone delivery into some of the rural areas in northern Michigan. And I've heard about this for many years. I just had not seen an actual project that had been realized here in the US, but I'm sure there are some that I just am not aware of.
The continent where to go to see this is actually not Europe, it's Africa. The amount of innovation in the combination of drone plus AI in Africa is amazing. Given the fact that the continent has a very weak infrastructure, despite for cellular phones, I in Germany still pay things cash. So we are really living in the dinosaurs. If I would do the same thing somewhere in Africa, they would look at me and go like, are you from Stone Age? Did you just beam yourself here through time? What are you doing? They pay with their phones already for 15 years, basically. And so for them, using drones to deliver medication to remote locations are big services. The innovation on the African continent is magnificent to see.
It's interesting. One of the things I did want to touch on too is there's many physicians who I would say are entrepreneurial, but who work for larger organizations and who want to lead innovation within larger established healthcare companies, but they face a certain resistance to change. Is there an approach that you have found, you've worked for large healthcare organizations, and I'm sure that your personality and your interest in entrepreneurship has been relatively consistent over your adult life. But do you have any advice or thoughts on how to deal with that situation rather than someone who's starting up their own company and trying to innovate kind of outside of industry?
That's a superb question. The first answer is look for the right people. I worked in very large organizations like Stryker, like Abbott, and like Guidant Corporation. And I was absolutely fortunate to have people that I was reporting to, like David Holliday in Stryker or Peter Held in Guidant, who were embracing the craziness of this young physician. Okay. And they were not afraid. They were mature enough. They were settled in their own beliefs so that they could allow for a certain amount of flexibility, which an innovation in as a bottom line is, do that. I learned in Abbott that even in a more than 100-year-old corporation, if you have the right people around you, you are welcome to do innovation. So it boiling down to find the right people, something that I learned at Stryker more than anything else. It's about people. It's not about the structure that you're in, because structure can be changed. People, not so much. Mm-hmm. They have a certain basis set that they won't move from. The second thing is, if you are facing resistance and you do not want or cannot move somewhere else, then the most important thing is understand where it comes from. Is this resistance something that you could learn something from? So is it something that you are maybe in love with your product baby or service baby that you are trying to bring to fruition? But is there maybe something they see you don't? And take it into consideration. Embrace it. Try to understand why the resistance is there. Is there somebody who has something to lose? So are we talking about disrupting a product flow that is super profitable for something that is much less profitable, but has way, way, way more patient value? Right? Is it personal? Yeah. Is it envy? Is it, what is it, right? Is it structural? Is it a structure where you have to have 50 people on board and a big meeting before everybody says yes? Once you understand that, you can then move to, is it politics? Is it geography? Or is it cultural? Or is it even religious? And the bottom question is it your application that creates the resistance? Is it too complex? Did you overdesign it? Are you capable of putting your added value to the patient into one sentence? Are you able to measure it with a maximum of four different values? If you are, you're good. If you're not, go back to your own drawing board. So most of the time, resistance to me is based out of the anxiety in a corporation that something that seems not yet a safe bet, to put your own career chips on that. And that's something that happens a lot. So people are always happy to be on a ship that sails in the sun, a ship where they don't know whether it's actually a ship or a submarine, sailing it in stormy weather on day one. You won't have probably less friends, but better friends for a longer time.
So it sounds like, if I was to summarize that, I would say that when you face barriers and challenges and they're being put in your way by people around you, it's important to try to gain insight into why those barriers are there and not just assume that the person doesn't understand your idea. You have to be able to question your own idea and look for ways to make it better when you face these types of situations, it sounds like. And if you take it personally, if you assume a level of ignorance on the person who's putting the barriers in front of you, you're not as likely to be successful in the long run.
And let me add one point, because you just raised that question. You need to be able to translate what you invented into different languages. So I'm a physician. I'm talking physician language. Mm-hmm. The other person might be a finance guy. He wants to understand the finances behind it. He wants to know why this works. The sales guy wants to know, how is the messaging towards their target group, and why, even if it is disrupting, why should they put their own weight, their connection to the customers, behind your idea? Mm-hmm. And one method that is absolutely amazing to do that is Lean Six Sigma, which is taught at the University of Tennessee, because it allows you to translate things into process. And I figured that out by accident, because when I went to Pemba in 2003, it was not yet part of the curriculum. It was later added to it. And I was very, very lucky to still have very good contact to some of the professors there. And so I went back to school to actually learn it. The important thing here is that once you translate it into a neutral language, and I'm not saying Lean Six Sigma is the only one, you will need to figure out a neutral language that everybody else can learn with a minimum amount of requirement of time to learn that language and the maximum ability to basically bring across a message without losing information. Okay. Because once the finance guy understands why your product is great in his language, he can communicate this into his peer group. Same for the salespeople. And this is something that most of us physicians don't do very well in the beginning. We are very, very clinical oriented. Clinical orientation is the foundation of a product. Is it worth doing it? Yes or no? But there are plenty of other questions that come afterwards that other people would either help you be neutral or be more or less not so neutral about it.
You've mentioned PEMBA a couple of times in our interview, and I wanted to ask you, what, being from the EU, why did you choose to pursue an MBA in the US, and why did you specifically choose the PEMBA program to complete your MBA?
I actually chose PEMBA. Before PEMBA, I never had my foot in the US. I was very much Asia-oriented in my entire career. So I found out about PEMBA during the process of actually looking for an MBA program. I had been offered by my employer top-notch European MBAs. I was a fully certified physician, and in most of those MBAs, they were targeted at people around 22, 25, either saving the world in one day or making as much money as you can in two. And none of that was really my motivation to do an MBA. My motivation to do an MBA was that I had figured out that in med school, you learn nothing about economics, but it actually is one of the foundations of doing good healthcare. You need money to do healthcare. There's no other way. And the second thing is you learn nothing about leading people. And so that was my motivation to choose an MBA program. And I found out about PEMBA by accident through an article of the German Handelsblatt, which is the equivalent to the Wall Street Journal in the US, which was writing about PEMBA as being a physician-only program. And that appeared a lot to me. But the person who really won me over was a gentleman called Tom Brown, who is running the program from an organizational standpoint. And the way he behaved towards my first email, I immediately felt, and I know it sounds exaggerated, but I felt at home. I knew this, if everybody else would be like this, this would be a perfect fit, and it was a perfect fit for me. It was great from the very first contact with this university, despite me not being a native speaker, being in different time zones, and so on and so forth. And we talked 2003 here. This was the time when still voice of IP systems were working with very funny modems that were actually playing music, more or less, for everybody who remembers that and is old enough to remember that. And so the technical issues were not known in the beginning. And so they actually helped me with every single step.
Great. When you took the MBA program, would you say that there was one aspect of the program that you got value from that you really didn't anticipate getting value from when you began the program?
There were two. The first one is content-wise. Content-wise, I did not realize before joining the program that I would be offered all the facets I would need to do actually entrepreneurial business, and that I just had to put them together like a puzzle. The second thing, content-wise, is that I learned something that has never left me afterwards, is that what the two of us do right now, which is hybrid working together, actually would work with people that are highly educated and in very complex situations. Before that, I would have probably believed that if you wouldn't go to a physician colleague in a hospital and explain the things on site with him, you wouldn't be able to transport the value. After PEMBA, I knew this was absolutely feasible, and there were actually advantages in combining the feet on the ground with the online, because it actually increased the frequency of interaction. Therefore, it actually increased the value to the customer at that time. From a personal standpoint, I would have expected two things. The one thing is that Kate actually is running a program in there that basically does a psychological evaluation of yourself, which gives you a pretty clear picture of who you are. This picture is still correct today. And it was an amazing value. It guided me in a lot of decisions that I made, wrong and right, both of them. But that is an amazing thing I did not expect. And from a very personal thing is, if you told me before the MBA that within 1 year of hybrid education, I would be able to establish personal relationships that till today, 22 years later, I would consider friends and that I can at any time, in the professors as well as in the students, I would have probably smiled, but not believed. But if this is the case, and this is the beauty about this hybrid concept that Mike Stahl, Professor Emeritus of Pemba, brought to fruition and life, it's going on site for a very short amount of time that a physician actually can invest during his professional life in parallel to his professional life, wherever you come from on this globe. And on the other hand, having the very high frequency interaction with your peers and professors using live online situations. So every Pemba knew 20 years before COVID that hybrid works. Simple as that.
Well, thank you for those insights into Pemba. I always like to talk with alumni about their Pemba experience because I find it fascinating how different people experience Pemba differently and take away different things. But everyone that I've talked to has expressed the value that Pemba has given them and the impact that it's had on their careers differently. But everyone has, I mean, it has impacted all of us in positive ways. I look back at my Pemba experience very fondly. I mean, for me, it was transformational in terms of the things that it has allowed me to do with my career subsequent to that. So thank you for taking the time to share that with us. We've pretty much reached the end of our time here. So I want to thank you for coming on the show. I really appreciate you taking the time to spend with the alumni today and to record this podcast with me.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share some thoughts. And if anybody has any questions, just reach out to me directly. You know where to get me anyway. And we'll figure this out.
Yes, and we will share the links for you to contact Hank Schiffers in our show notes. So we'll give you his LinkedIn profile, which I think, Hank, is that the best way to reach you is through LinkedIn? I know I've been pretty successful with that.
Well, LinkedIn, for those that have it, is a very simple way. Otherwise, through Pemba, my email address is still valid there.
All right. I'll include all of that in the show notes. And again, thank you for taking the time. And please don't forget that we will be having another podcast in 2 weeks. So please join us for that. And thank you for taking the time to join us on the show today. Thank you again, Hank, for joining us today. We appreciated your insights regarding entrepreneurship, monetization of innovative ideas, differences in the startup processes in the US and the EU, as well as the differences between monetizing new products in a regulatory field or controlled by regulators and products that are going to be released in the self-improvement space. I found it fascinating to learn about the differences in speed to market and the differences in how quickly you could expect a steady revenue stream in the two different markets that we focused on today. That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.